Okay. The start?
Yeah, just
go.
Okay, you're on.
Okay. All right, guys. I just wanted to start quickly with a discussion. Do you guys have any questions about any of the material that you went through? Anything that you're reading on your own that, you know, you might want to discuss or you have questions about? Or anything that interests you with regard to the class so far? I just want to see how you're getting used to the material. Because I remember when I was a Christian, when I was a young Christian, it was learning philosophy and learning apologetics was challenging. And I remember just trying to learn a few terms, and I had to, you know, keep on turning back to the glossary to figure out these terms and such. But it gets easier. So do you guys have any... anything so far? If not, we'll jump in. And if people come in late, that's fine.
I just have a random question.
Sure.
How long have you been a Christian?
Since over half my life now, so since around 7th grade. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's been a while. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time. So, all right. Today, we're going to kind of continue the discussion. Jeremy said, I talked to him today, that you guys went through tactics in defending the faith. And how to do it in a more personal level. It's one thing to know particular arguments, or let's say particular mistakes that people make in arguments. And it's another thing to know when to use them. How to bring it up in an interpersonal situation so that things don't feel funny or awkward or things like that. So that's something that you guys will have to learn. It's just being tactful. There's a certain time and place for things, and other times not. So with that said, we're going to go through, in the first half, how to make an argument. This is really interesting because I remember when I was young, in, let's say, high school, we would have these assignments that were critical thinking assignments, right? And I remember, we had so many of these, I remember, why don't they actually teach me how to think? They're just giving me scenarios and saying, right. And they're not giving me actual rules or anything like that. So I was a little bit frustrated. And it gave me the sense that, you know what, I guess people just have that. Some people just know how to think. And I guess I'm just not that kind of person. I just don't have that skill. But it turns out, thanks to philosophy, you know what, you can learn that skill, and it's helpful. It doesn't mean that we turn into robots or we can't communicate with people or anything like that. We don't become machines, but when you need to turn on the skill, let's say someone comes to you and gives you an argument for God's non-existence or something like that, let's say from the problem of evil, that's when you need to turn it on. Now, a normal conversation, you can just be relaxed and just be yourself and such, but there are times when you need to have that skill, when you need to be very precise and listen carefully. So we're going to talk about that today. First, we're going to lay the foundation of what is an argument? What do I mean by that? What are the parts? And then we're going to get to, in the second half, something more practical. We're going to talk about the informal fallacies, as they're called, just general mistakes in reasoning that seem to pop up a lot with regard to humanity. And the good thing is, if we can avoid them, then that's helpful to us. Then that means we're probably better off insofar as we're reasoning. All right? Quickly, let me just define logic. Logic is the study of reliable or correct patterns of thought, being able to draw or infer the right conclusions from the evidence. A lot of times, when you're discussing something with someone, it isn't about the evidence, so to speak. You and the other person could actually have the exact same evidence before you. So the question is, what conclusions do you draw from the evidence? So this is really important. I said maybe most of our arguments aren't actually about matters of fact. They may, in fact, be more about our interpretation, what conclusions do we draw, et cetera, et cetera. So here's what we want to do. We want to study logic. We want to study patterns of reasoning that are reliable. There are certain methods for doing things, but not all methods are reliable. So, for example, let's say I said, I know tomorrow the Lakers are going to make a trade. I know this to be the case. 100% certain. And you say, well, how? So you're asking me about my method. And I say, well, I flip the coin. Heads are going to make a trade, tails are not. Now notice that's a method, right? But we would say that's not reliable. It's not a reliable method. If I was correct, it would just be because of happenstance, right? I just got lucky. We don't want to just get lucky with our methods of reasoning. We want reliable patterns that we can follow, that we can be assured 80, 90%, you know what, this is pretty good. So that's what we're going to talk about today. When you philosophize and when you do apologetics, you're doing philosophy. Because apologetics, I think about it as applied philosophy. So they're taking all the great arguments from these different people, different Christian scholars and philosophers and such, and they're bringing them to bear on this very important topic of, is Christianity true or not? I think it's the key to reasoning. It's the key to philosophizing. Meaning, if you don't have logic, you're probably not doing philosophy. I think it's one of the necessary conditions to philosophize. I think if you are trying to philosophize without it, you're just musing on something. You're just speculating. But when you're trying to aim for truth, we need a reliable method. And the goal isn't enough. This is an interesting thing. We could all have the same goal, but if we don't have a method, then it almost doesn't matter what goal we have. So for example, let's say you have the goal of maintaining your buoyancy in the ocean, right? Keeping your head above water. And let's say I push you in the ocean. If you don't have a method, by that I mean a means, a technique to accomplish that goal, you're going to drown. I mean, I know you have the goal to stay afloat, but do you have the means? Do you have the way to do it, the technique? So this is, we can think about this as the way to get to our goal of truth, the way to extract or draw out or derive the correct conclusions from the data. Because we're constantly bombarded all the time with different sets of data, right? So the question is, what conclusions do we draw from that? If it were the case that we found out that aliens existed, what conclusions do we draw from that fact insofar as it relates to Christianity? So that would be an example. I mean, whether or not it happens, the question is, how relevant is it to our faith? Some people think it's very relevant. It would destroy our faith. Others don't think so. So you need to have an argument for that. You need to have reasons for that. So, quickly, how is the term argument used in our common culture? So when people, you know, throw this term back and forth, how is it typically used?
Disagreement.
Okay, the disagreement. Good, good. Like a fight sometimes, right? So typically, they have what's called a negative connotation. So those of you that don't know, connotation is a sense, and denotation is the dictionary definition. So when I'm saying this, I'm saying people don't typically like to have arguments, right? It doesn't feel good when you argue a lot. Here's an example of an argument. So if you do know what that means, then good, you can explain it to other people. I'm not going to explain it right now. But what this quote is saying is that when you're building a case for something, the smallest unit of an assertion is an argument. And we'll talk about that. So what's the smallest unit of reasoning that I can push out there that actually does something, that will actually prove my case? And we'll talk about the parts in a second. So the smallest complete unit of reasoning. So here are the basic elements. Typically in an argument, you'll have at least three parts. You have at least two premises and one conclusion. Now I'm going to talk in a second about this inference. That's the principle by which you draw out the conclusion from the evidence. But typically you'll have at least three sentences, let's say. Hi. And so this inference part is really important. That's how you get the conclusion from the data. And by the way, I will email you guys the slides and things like that. So just feel free to just look. And you can take notes if you want, but I'm going to email those to you as well. Okay? So don't feel like you have to furiously take notes or anything like that. All right, an argument is a set of statements that are related. One is said to follow from or be justified by the others. What's necessary in an argument is however many statements you have, they're related to each other. There are different types of statements, right? Imperative, interrogative, things like that. But typically with arguments, you only use declarative. And there's a purpose for this, because only declarative statements are possibly true or false. So if I say, it is raining outside, that's possibly true or false. Whereas if I said, please close the door, that's not possibly true or false. You don't argue over that. How hot is it? That's not possibly true or false, right? So typically you want to use declarative statements. Now I'm going to get a little bit specific with regard to how we derive the conclusions from the premises. We're going to talk about the connection in a second. So I'm going to get a little bit specific. There's going to be a little bit of terminology. Just try to absorb it as best you can. Remember, I'm going to give you the slides. A lot of this stuff you learn by repetition, to be honest. The first time I read things, I didn't know what's going on. Well, like one of my martial arts professors used to say, the reason you can't pull something off isn't because the move is inferior, it's because you haven't put the reps in. You haven't repeated enough. So I want to encourage you guys to keep on repeating. Even if something doesn't make sense immediately, it may. And I've experienced that a ton of times where I thought something was false and then you get that flash of insight, it makes sense. Kind of like math in elementary school. You're copying these symbols, you don't know what they mean. Just copying them and one day, 1 + 1 = 2. I understand. So an argument, we need however many statements there are to be related. Two types of relations, quickly. When you hear this word entailment, what it basically means is if the premises I use are true, then the statement must be true. So that's what entailment means. So when you hear someone say, this is entailed by that, they're saying, you know, if that is true, then this must be true. It's impossible for this not to be true. And certain types of argument take this strong form. So there's an argument against God's existence that takes this strong form of entailment. Meaning, it's not just the case that God doesn't exist, but he can't. That is, it is impossible that God exists. So that's how strong the first one is, so to speak. Now quickly, the second basing is just less than entailment. Most of our arguments utilize the basing. So what I mean is, whatever evidence I give you, that just raises the conclusion's truth value a little bit. Or whatever. Not fully, just in part. So these are the two kinds of relations. If you don't remember the exact words, basing and entailment, that's okay. Just remember, these are the relations that we need. And let me get into that a little bit more. Okay. We're going to talk about deductive arguments today. That's just a certain kind. And at the end, there'll be a chart. It'll help you see all this, where this goes where, entailment goes with deductive, things like that. Quickly, a non sequitur. You've heard this term before. It's simply Latin for does not follow. When I call something a non sequitur, when someone calls that my argument a non sequitur, what they're saying is, I actually have no argument. That means the set of statements I've given, they're actually not related to each other. They're all separate. Here's what I mean. Who knows what this is? The symbol.
Bad guy.
Neighborhood watch, right? It's the idea that, hey, look out for strangers. Look out for people that aren't supposed to be there, that have no relation to anyone else. They're not friends, they're not family, they're just random people. Well, watch out, be suspicious. This is the idea of a non sequitur. When someone's calling my, you know, four sentences are non sequitur. They're saying they're all strangers, that there's no relationship among them. They're not like a family or a group. So this is not what we want. And if you're making the case for something, you want all your statements to be related. They're all pushing the same point. You don't want any to stand out, you know, to be a total stranger from the rest. And we're going to go through some examples today. I think that'll be helpful. I know this sounds a little esoteric right now, but we'll go through concrete examples. So, let me give you three statements purported to be an argument. You guys, and let's talk about this. The first premise, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Two, Switzerland exports many cuckoo clocks. Three, therefore, the therefore means a conclusion. Therefore, capital punishment is immoral. So, what do you guys think? Is this an argument or is it a non sequitur? Why? Good. It doesn't follow. They're not related. One way to think about this is let's say in statement one or statement two, there was a dial associated with it, and I could change its truth value. I could turn it all the way down, room, and it'd be false. Or I can turn it all the way up, room, 100% true. The question is, if I tweaked that dial, would it affect the other statements? So statement one, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Let's say I tweaked that room all the way down to false. What does that say about the other statements? Does that do anything to the other statements? No, nothing at all. It's that means it's completely irrelevant. That means it's completely independent. And for an argument, that's not what we want. We don't want independent statements. If they're related, when I tweak one, it changes the rest. That's what it means by relation. And this is exactly the same as in familial relations, so to speak. So let's say you have a close bond with your family, and someone, unfortunately, let's say, doesn't feel that well or something like that. It brings everyone down. That's the sense of a relation. So that is a bad argument. It's just not an argument. Many times people use the term bad argument for just no argument. They're just all independent statements. They're not a cohesive whole. So how about this one? Oh, okay, so I mentioned the irrelevancy, right? They're all independent, and that's not what we want when we make an argument. We're making a case for something. Let's say we're arguing there's a certain family member, maybe they're falsely imprisoned, and we go to court and we try to defend them. Everything we say should be to the goal of their innocence. That there shouldn't be anything we say that has nothing to do with their innocence, right? They should all be relevant. Now, don't be fooled sometimes when you see what's supposed to be an argument and you see, hey, a lot of those things are true. You know, yeah, Columbus sailed this and I know Switzerland does that. And hey, I think, you know, capital punishment is immoral. It must be an argument. Not necessarily, so don't be fooled. It could be the case that all the statements are true, but they're independently true. Remember, once again, like I talked about tweaking the truth values, right? If they're related, I shouldn't be able to tweak without changing the others. So here's another one. Premise one, it is immoral to kill persons. Two, capital punishment is the killing of persons. Three, therefore, capital punishment is immoral. So argument or non sequitur? What do you guys think? Okay, good. It's pretty obvious if I tweak one, it affects the others, right? So for example, if the first I changed room all the way down to false, that totally affects the rest, right? You can't get the conclusion if number one is false, right? So this is an argument. The point now isn't whether or not it's a good one. But we can see a lot of times, even if it's not the best argument, that at least it's trying to be an argument. So there's that relevancy thing, right? They're all relevant to each other. None of the statements are strangers. So I actually don't agree with that argument, but it's pretty clear it's an argument. And if you guys have any questions at any time, any terminology, or even just for review, just please let me know, okay? Now we're going to talk about the form of an argument. So we've already said, hey, when I put statements together, let's say defending God's existence or defending the existence of my, you know, my relative in court or whatever, that they should all be related, right? Now we're going to talk about the look, so to speak, the pattern. And we're going to get a little bit more specific in that sense. So this is by way of review, at least two premises, one conclusion. Premises, just understand them as declarative sentences, just full sentences. So at least we need three full sentences. So the premises, they justify, they uphold the conclusion. Meaning if you didn't have the premises, you took them away, the conclusion wouldn't be valid. So these are just examples of some words that sometimes help tip you off to the idea that these statements are meant to serve as premises. So since, because, inasmuch as, otherwise, for this reason, something like that. So the conclusion is based on the premises. The conclusion is derived from the premises. So we extract the conclusion from the premises. So some conclusion signals. The most obvious is therefore. When I say therefore, I mean all the other stuff I said previous, it's to this point. That's what I'm trying to get at. So in conclusion, that we see things like that. Now I'll give you guys an analogy of what an argument is, just so an image hopefully sticks in your head. You can think of the conclusion like the roof of a house and the premises like the walls. Remember, there's no such thing. You can't walk into a house that has a roof but doesn't have walls. It doesn't make sense, right? So something like this. The conclusion is always upheld by the premises. And when you read more and more, you know, philosophers and apologists and such, you'll see this is what they're trying to do. Not only do we want the conclusion that, for example, therefore God exists, but we need to provide the support for it. Because some people just don't accept that statement just if we say it. God exists. Some might. They might accept it. But others might say, hey, what support do you have? How did you get to that conclusion? Tell me the way, the method by which you got to that conclusion. And we should be able to do that. Now, there are two general types of arguments. The first is called deductive. The way it's set up here is that basically you're reasoning from something very wide to something much smaller in particular. So, one, all humans are mortal. See how wide that is? The scope of the statement? Two, Socrates is mortal. Three, therefore, two, Socrates is human. Three, therefore, Socrates is mortal. So you see, we go from very wide down to very particular, which is one guy. So this is one way to understand deductive arguments. Not the only way, but it's helpful to think of it this way. Contrast this with inductive arguments. So you're always going to see those terms, deductive, inductive. A lot of times, these two twin terms kind of contrast it. It reasons the opposite, let's say. So specific to general. So we start off kind of small and hopefully build up to some sort of wider conclusion. It would look something like this. One, Socrates is mortal. Two, Plato is mortal. Three, Aristotle is mortal. Vivaldi, Tim, you, me. Hey, maybe everyone's mortal. So this is the opposite type of reasoning. And scientists used to think they only did this kind of reasoning. So when you read Newton, Bacon, things like that, they used to only think so. The paradigm has changed a little bit nowadays, but you guys get the point. Okay. Let's move on. Okay. I'm just going to skip this. Don't worry. You guys will still be able to have it. Now we're going to talk about form a little bit. With deductive arguments, it really matters the look, the pattern. With inductive, it doesn't matter that much. And that's why the second part, we're going to talk about a lot of inductive fallacies. It's much easier to understand because you don't have to worry about a look or a certain pattern. Well, with deductive, you do have to worry about that, and I'm going to give you an example. It's just, you know what, when you want to make your strongest case, you do it so it's like airtight. And this is what deductive arguments are trying to give you, this airtight kind of thing that no one can get through. So when a form is correct deductively, when the pattern is correct, it's considered valid. So that's part one, but we don't want to just stay there, okay? When you have the correct pattern plus you have true premises, that's called soundness. So it's called a sound argument. And we'll look at examples of these. So when we're making arguments that the conclusion is supposed to follow 100%, which is deductive, we want to make sure they're sound. So the premises are true plus the pattern is right. Here's what I mean by pattern. Very, very common pattern. Okay? It's just called modus ponens. When you see sometimes logic in letters, just think of these letters as standing for declarative sentences. And the arrow means if then. So you can put anything in there. A, if it is raining outside, B, then it will be wet. Premise two, it is raining outside, and we get the conclusion, the little triple dot, therefore it should be wet outside, something like that. So this is an example of a right pattern. Okay? This is a reliable pattern, remember? Certain patterns aren't reliable, for example, like flipping a coin, that method is not reliable. This method is reliable, you can count on it. If your reasoning is following this, you know it's reliable. So examples of this. Here's one. If the moon is made of green cheese, then Nike will go bankrupt. The moon is made of green cheese. Three, therefore Nike will go bankrupt. So my question to you is this valid? Yes. Okay, good. You guys are on track. That fools a lot of, I teach college kids, that fools a lot of kids, right? It is valid because the form is correct. Remember the if A then B, A therefore B? Even though everything's false, all the premises are false, right? But once again, the form is right. So they have, the person that would say this has one part correct. Now we just want the other part. We want the premises to be true as well. So good, this is valid, but let's shoot for the whole thing. We want true premises as well. But it's not sound, right? No one would agree to those premises. Whatever constitution the moon is made of has nothing to do with Nike going bankrupt, right? So here's an interesting thing, like we saw. An argument can be valid even if all the statements are false. And we just saw that with green cheese and things like that. They're all false. Nike's not going bankrupt, the moon isn't made of green cheese. But on the flip side, this is why we have to kind of be careful, right? It can be also invalid if everything is true. We might see a set of statements and this guy says, this is an argument to why God is not triune. God is only one person. And it could be a lot of the disjointed things he says are true, but it could be the case as well that the form is incorrect. Go ahead.
Would you say that third statement is a non sequitur or not?
Yeah, I would.
In other words, it is valid, but because the statements are not true, then...
They're actually not related, yeah. So I'd say something like that.
Okay, all
right. Yeah, so... I would say that the conclusion does not follow. So, yeah. But, you know, once again, even if it did, that would... Anyways, let's move on to another example. So, I kind of talked about this a little bit. If it is raining outside, then my driveway will be wet. Be careful. My driveway is wet, therefore it is raining outside. Now, what is wrong with this? So, remember the form that I talked about. Go ahead.
What's wrong with it is because the driveway could be wet for other reasons than the rain.
Okay. Good. Exactly. Exactly. This is an invalid form because, just like you mentioned, it could be wet for any number of reasons. So this is, and I'll show this to you, it's instead of if A then B, A, which was the correct one, it's if A then B, B. Right? So it should say, if it's correct, number two, my driveway, I'm sorry, it is raining outside. Let me show this to you guys. And you'll actually see this pattern, this unreliable pattern. But just because the driveway is wet does not entail that it rained, even though if it rained, it does entail that the driveway would be wet. So it goes one way, it doesn't go the other. And here's why. This is the good one, modus ponens. This is the one we're familiar with right now. Here's the bad one that I just showed you. If A, then B, B, therefore A. This is the bad one. So this fallacy means mistake. So, but you see how close it was. That's why we have to be careful sometimes. So this is an example of a correct valid form, and this is an example of a fallacy of that form. And this is all the forms we're going to go through today. It's merely to give you an example of what a logical argument would look like. Sometimes if you read philosophy books, they'll be very precise in things like this, and just so you can read it. But in normal conversation, you just kind of have to pick up what people say and kind of try to put it yourself into a coherent pattern. Okay, so I mentioned this. We want soundness in our arguments. So we want a good form, but we also want true premises. And I mentioned this as well, declarative statements, remember? That's pretty much the only type we use for the most part because they're the only statements that are possibly true or false. It's no, you can't argue over, can you please close the door? Or, you know, it's not possibly true or false in this philosophical sense. You can't argue about, I don't want to close the door. That's different. Quickly, I've been talking about true premises. Well, how do you know if a premise is good enough to be used in an argument? That's a very valid question. How much certainty do I need? So I line up all these statements, and they're supposed to prove my conclusion, right? Let's say I have seven statements. They're all aimed at the appropriate place to, you know, prove my friend is innocent or whatever, to prove that God exists. Well, what's good enough? Here's what's good enough. It's more probable than its negation. So when you think of negation, you think opposite. And it's really easy to make a statement into a negation. Just stick a not in somewhere. So it is raining outside. It is, boom, not raining outside. That's its negation. If any statement is very easy. The sun's burning brightly. The sun is not burning brightly. Something like that. So all you have to do is look at a statement and its negation. Now, is the statement more probable than its negation? If it is, that's good enough. You don't need 100% certainty. Very rarely do we argue, do we have strong enough proof that it's 100% certain. Very rarely. Most of the time, we're arguing about probabilities. So you know what? If that statement you want to use or that evidence you want to use is more probable than its opposite, that's okay. So that's what we're shooting for. That's a kind of practical consideration. Now, inductive arguments, you just don't need to worry about any of the stuff I just told you. With regard to soundness or form or things like that, inductive arguments don't really have a form. You might just see it as a paragraph, sentences and things. And I'll give you some examples. But you don't have to worry about that. And most of the times we use inductive arguments. Just a few things you have to know about inductive arguments. The conclusion is never certain. Even if the premises are 100% true. Now let's get to reasoning patterns. Ways in which we reason. And I'm going to give you five that are very common. So these are methods of reasoning. So this way. Most of our reasoning comes by way of these methods. And we're going to talk about each with examples. Generalization by sign, cause, analogy, or authority. So an inductive or deductive argument can both use these types of reasoning. So first, a generalization. Because the sun has risen every day I've ever experienced, you know, my life, and in the lives of others in all recorded history, it will probably rise tomorrow. So that's an inductive argument. It doesn't follow with certainty. In fact, we know it will be false one day because the sun might become something like a red giant. You know, the earth is not going to be here, so the sun won't rise forever. But, you know, we reason like this, right? That it would be very strange of us. All of us would be very surprised if tomorrow the sun didn't rise. Once again, it doesn't have to be 100% certain, but this is reasonable. Here's another one by sign. Since skin cancer is usually accompanied by moles changing their shape and color, my own mole changing its shape and color could indicate that I have skin cancer. That's getting very reasonable as well. Some things are signs of other things. That is, reliable indicators of something going on. So probably if your car is all smoking underneath its hood and things, that's an indicator something is wrong, right? So we reason like this pretty commonly. Here's another one, causally. I always seem to be more depressed in the winter months. So maybe my depression is actually caused by the seasonal change. This is a real disorder. It's called seasonal affective disorder. So in this instance, the change in seasons actually caused the change in my mood. Analogy. And you might hear these in the debates. Since healthcare plan X worked for Texas, which has similar demographics to California, healthcare plan X should work for California as well. Something like this. This is like an analogy. If you have friends, maybe they're on a certain fitness plan that works well and you think you're kind of similar to them, hey, why not try it out? It may work for me. We're similar enough. And one more. Authority. So 9 out of 10 doctors recommend you should take a multivitamin every day. Therefore, you should take a multivitamin every day. Very common reasoning. You see this all the time in the commercials, right? So here are some common ways that we reason. When we get to the informal fallacies, it'll be a little bit easier because you won't have to remember a certain form or anything like that. It's just this is a bad way to think about things. So we'll go ahead and talk about that. Let me show you guys a short video clip and we'll talk about it a little bit. It doesn't necessarily deal with the things that we're talking about, but sometimes it's fun and it can kind of bring up some philosophical issues. This is what's very interesting to me in philosophy. There's a certain ubiquitousness about philosophy, meaning it keeps on popping up everywhere. You can't get rid of it. So this would be an example. So for us, we're going to look at these informal fallacies. So they're not having anything to do with the form, you know, if A then B, that type of thing. So you don't need to know the form of them. Oh yeah, so this is just the general picture to summarize deductive and inductive arguments. So just everything I've been saying, just a kind of summary of it. And let me make sure this is loud enough. Okay, hopefully this works. Maybe not. I have it here. Sorry about that, guys. Maybe it still doesn't work. I'll try to figure this out maybe in the break. So it's about an hour through, and let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break, and you guys get up and chat or whatever, and we'll just come back in 10 minutes, and we'll finish up. So we want to utilize this principle of charity. So big warning is a fallacy essential to their argument. This is what we want to find out. Because it's really easy to pick out certain things people say in everyday conversation. That's not our point. Our point is, if someone's making a serious point, now let's look at their argument with a little bit more care and let's judge whether or not we think that fallacy actually applies or not. So quickly, what is a fallacy? You've heard me use the term. It's just a mistake, some sort of mistaken reasoning. And we'll see the very common patterns that people find themselves in over and over, which are mistakes. And hopefully that will help us to not make those mistakes. So this is kind of dovetailing onto our other discussion. If there's a mistake, that means the premises they use don't give the conclusion. That's what we want. We want the premises to be all be relevant to each other, all connected, and somehow we can extract the conclusion from the premises. But if there's a disconnection, then there's some fallacy going on somewhere. There's some mistaken reasoning going on somewhere. Okay, it's just non sequitur. A fallacy is just non sequitur. Just does not follow. Now, logic gets tricky because there are many examples of something being, on the one hand, a valid way of reasoning, and on the other hand, a fallacy, but they're so close. They're so close. And I'll give you an example of this. But you have to realize there's always these kind of coins with two sides. A fallacy is always so close to this valid way of reasoning. So here's one. I mentioned last session that a reliable way of reasoning is this by authority, right? 9 out of 10 doctors recommend multivitamins. But in this list I'm going to email you, you're going to see that there's a fallacy too called an appeal to authority. So you guys, wait a second. Can I use authority or can't I? I mean, why don't you guys make up your mind? Well, it all has to do with how you use it. So, an appeal to authority is correct if the authority's expertise is relevant. Just because they're an expert in one area, let's say a Richard Dawkins with regard to biology, doesn't mean he's an expert in another area, let's say religion or philosophy, right? And what would be incorrect is someone has authority and expertise, but it's not relevant to our discussion. That would be an improper use of authority. So, 9 out of 10 doctors recommend you take a multivitamin, right? We accept this as valid. It doesn't have to be 100% certain, because doctors make mistakes sometimes. For example, I don't know if you guys have seen the older commercials where they used to say, smoking is good for you. It increases your lung capacity and things like that. They used to actually have commercials like that, doctors advocating smoking. Now we know it's not the case. But nevertheless, I don't think that warrants complete skepticism with all doctors, like everything they say is false. You know, for the most part, you can trust them. So here the expertise is relevant. We're talking about a multivitamin, whether or not you should take it. And a doctor has relevant expertise. So this is fine. Remember, it doesn't have to be 100% certain. But for the most part, it's okay to reason like this. It's pretty reliable. Go ahead.
What kind of fallacy would it be if you're putting this commercial together and you just happen to have 10 doctors that you handpicked, mm-hmm. you know what they're going to say, but they're not representative. So you're only slightly lying if you say 9 out of 10 doctors.
It could be the case that what we think it means is 9 out of the 10 doctors, and that's expansive, meaning, let's say out of 1,000, 9 out of 10, you know. What if it's actually just 9 out of 10, and then they handpicked the 10? And then the one that said no, they were surprised, like, what, we paid you, wait a second, you know. So you have to be careful, it's true, you have to be careful. But let me give you an example that's very similar to yours. So let's just say, in general, this is okay to reason like this. If it is the case that actually 9 out of 10 doctors, like, let's say 90% say, and it's not just a select group, this is pretty good. Here is one that's probably not so good. Airborne. Have you guys used this before? I know some people love it. And my arrow says, created by a school teacher. Draw your attention to that. Well, and of course it's put on the front as a means to persuade you, right, to take this because, hey, not just anybody came up with it, a school teacher. Well, I think this is an inappropriate appeal to authority. Let me tell you why. Well, what teacher are we talking about? Does the teacher have any relevant expertise in the area of nutrition, or biology, or medicine, or whatever, right? Some sort of relevant expertise. So because you don't know what kind of doctor, what kind of teacher, what does that tell me? English teacher, you know, made the supplement that I should take? So it matters what kind of expertise they have. As it turns out, the lady happens to be an elementary school teacher with no particular expertise in nutrition or anything like that. So I think this is a fallacious appeal to authority. And this company has gotten into trouble. For example, Center for Science in the Public Interest. There is no credible evidence that what's in Airborne can prevent colds or prevent you from a germy environment. Airborne is basically an overpriced run-of-the-mill vitamin pill that's been cleverly but deceptively marketed. With regard to this company, they actually sued Airborne, and Airborne settled out of court for around $23 million. But it doesn't stop there. So, Federal Trade Commission. There is no competent and reliable scientific evidence to support the claims made by the defendants that Airborne tablets can prevent or reduce the risk of colds, sickness, or infection, protect against or help fight germs, reduce the severity or duration of a cold, and protect against cold, sickness, or an infection in crowded places such as airplanes, offices, or schools. And then they sued, and then Airborne lost another $30 million. So, not to beat up on Airborne, but you kind of see that made by a school teacher thing, they're making all these claims, but they couldn't back up their claims. What you're an expert in matters. I'm not an expert in nutrition and such. I have a certification in personal training, but I'm not going to go out there and make supplements. And I'm not sure a school teacher should have as well. I think that the claims were exaggerated early on, and you see this. So I think that's an inappropriate appeal to authority.
Were the claims disproved or just not proven?
Not proven.
Okay. But they didn't disprove the claims either, right?
Yeah, but the burden of proof is on the person that makes the claim. So if I'm airborne and I say, you know, fights colds and this and that and the other. Nowadays, the commercials don't say that because they got sued, you know, too much for it. But they used to say things like that. So the burden of proof is on the person who makes the claim. Airborne. Oh, go ahead. Yeah. I would think so. I would think a lot of them get sued a lot. But it may be the case that even with the amount that they get sued, it's still worth the money. So that could be the case as well. Yeah, exactly. It could be the case as well. So. Yeah, the Food and Drug Administration has to approve drugs. So supplements are different. They fall under another category. So they'll investigate something if they get enough complaints. Like people, people complaining and such. But typically, supplements aren't regulated. Like I said, unless there's some issue and people are suing them left and right, then the government will step in. Hey, you know, what are these claims? So I think, once again, this is an example of an inappropriate appeal to authority. So you see how it's two sides of the same coin, right? They're so similar, the fallacy and the correct way of reasoning. That's why we have to be sophisticated, and we have to take our time. We can't be quick to jump on people and, hey, that's a fallacy. You know, maybe not. So we're going to go through some examples, and the list I'll give you, it's maybe like 30 long or something with fallacies. And some of them take time to understand. Some of them take time to know. I'm going to try to show at least what I think are some of the more difficult ones so we can talk about them. And some of the ones are much easier. So, for example, like argumentum ad populum, an appeal to the masses. It's pretty obvious that just because the majority thinks something is correct doesn't mean it's correct, right? So the majority could have believed, and I think they did, that the earth was flat, but they were wrong. What does the majority mean? It doesn't mean anything with regard to truth. Right, the majority can be wrong. So that's an example of a fallacy. But you guys can kind of get the sense of that. So I'm going to talk about some of the more trickier ones.
The Galileo's problem.
What?
The majority.
Yeah, well, that was a complicated circumstance.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I think it was more the people in authority, actually. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The people in authority. So, yeah. All right. So, here's my second warning. Once again, these were things I would have wanted someone to tell me when I was first learning logical fallacies, because they're so interesting. But are you being sophisticated enough in your analysis? Are you taking your time? Are you not jumping to a conclusion? So, that's all the warnings I have. So the first is a false dichotomy. Now, when you give a false dichotomy, the number of options is always more than you've given. So it can be a false trichotomy or, you know, what have you. But typically, it's just called a false dichotomy. When you give people an option, a set of two options, but those don't happen to be the only options, but you're trying to force people into one or another, that's when it's a fallacy. It's misleading. Now, let me give you an example, going all the way back to Socrates. Here is a dilemma, supposedly, for theists. And typically with dilemmas, both sides, both choices are negative. It's like you pick your poison. If there was a dilemma, but one was really great, why wouldn't we choose the great one? It's the fact that both have sort of negative implications and we don't really want either, but the person is saying, you got to choose one or the other and they're both bad. So here is what's called the Euthyphro dilemma. Euthyphro is a person and a book. But here's the dilemma. Are actions good by definition simply because God commands them, or does God command them because they're good to begin with? So, Socrates in this dialogue is posing this to Euthyphro, and he's implying that there's these only two options. Now, on the face of it, you might not think, well, what's the dilemma? What's the big deal? I might not necessarily see that they're negative. Let me talk about that a little bit. Oh, many times dilemmas are the metaphor of horns is used. Like you're on the horns of a dilemma. So it's something like this. They're both supposed to hurt. You don't want to be in a dilemma. So let's talk about this Euthyphro dilemma. So let's talk about horn one. If actions are good simply because God commands them, then any action could be considered good in principle. It's possible for any action to be good in principle. That means there's no intrinsic difference between loving someone and a hate crime or something like that. There's no intrinsic difference. The only difference is God commanded one over the other. And that makes it automatically good. So, if God commanded that everyone punch babies, then in principle that would be good. Because what God commands, that's the definition of good. If God commands it, that's good. So whatever God would command. So we're not saying this is good, but we're saying in principle it could be if it were the case that God commanded it. So this seems to make God and goodness out to be arbitrary and capricious. Now there doesn't seem to be a genuine difference between, let's say, love and disgust and hate or things like that. It's only just because God commanded one, not the other. But God could have easily commanded the other, and we would have had to understand it as good. So that's horn one. Doesn't sound that attractive, right? Doesn't sound that attractive to me. Well, what about horn two? Oh, you don't want to try to punch babies. Some of them might fight back. That's an angry baby. Right. Sometimes I forget the slides that I put in. All right. So horn two. Remember, they're both supposed to have some disadvantage. On the other hand, if the things God commands are good because of some higher standard that God follows, then there is something greater than God that even he must follow. God turns out to be less than a perfectly maximal being, since there is something above God which he must conform to and abide by. There's something that he must yield to, which is the good out there. And God can't get away from that. He has to yield to it.
Where did the first statement come from, though?
What do you mean?
It doesn't make sense.
Like?
Well, okay, if the things God commands are good because of some higher standard that God follows, mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense.
Why?
Where did that statement come from?
It's just part of the Euthyphro dilemma. It's this Socratic Euthyphro dilemma. It's just I don't agree with it either. But this is Plato posing this problem to people that believe in God and such.
You could have, if anything, then there's something you could put in any statement there. That just seems ridiculous to me.
Well, I would agree with you, but the question is why. If there is some higher good which God must abide by, then he doesn't turn out to be maximal.
Well, they've also changed the definition of higher. In the first part of the first paragraph, mm-hmm. Higher means like maybe more moral, but then the greater is like more powerful than God. Those two words are different. The use of higher is different from the use of greater.
Well, let's just say they're the same. I think we could just plug them into to different places, and it probably mean the same thing. Just metaphorically higher,
okay.
not like spatially or anything like that. So, and I don't agree with this either, but we'll see why in a second. But when we say God is a maximal being, philosophers like to use that term. That just means any possible attribute, positive attribute that something can have, God has it, and he has it maximally. So, for example, we all have degrees of goodness within us, right? But God not only has the property of goodness, he has it maximally. So that makes him what we call omnibenevolent, all good, maximally good. It's the same thing with knowledge. Our knowledge is limited, right? There's some things I know, and some things I'm actually 100% certain of, but there's a lot of things I don't know. There's no way the scope of my knowledge is complete. But God's is. So his knowledge is maximum. We call him omniscient, all-knowing. So this is the way philosophers like to talk about God. But if it turns out there's something outside God that he must follow morally, then he's not maximal morally, because he's following something, he's yielding to something. He has to turn to something in order to tell him, hey, this is good, this is bad. So I do think there are drawbacks to this as well. I don't think either horn, for me, is attractive. Some Christians have tried to answer the dilemma within the question, so to speak. So they take on the horns directly, and they'll say, no, I actually think horn one is good, or horn two. Let me give you a way around the horns, which is a very old classical way of getting around the horns that Christian scholars have come up with. So Christian philosophers, they've called this a false dichotomy. You've tried to, you know, you, Socrates, you, Mr. Atheist, have tried to make my choices only two, and they're both negative. Hey, there might be another way through that. Now, when philosophers don't accept two horns of a dilemma, sometimes it's called metaphorically splitting the horns. So when you see that term, splitting the horns, that just means they don't accept either. So there's a third way. The dilemma was false. Instead of two, there's actually three, and I take the third. Here's what it is, a very classic answer to the Euthyphro dilemma. God's actions and commands flow from his very nature. What God does and what he commands is a direct reflection of who God is. So what is good has always been good. Since goodness has eternally and unchangingly been a part of God's nature. So it's not something outside God, and it's not God simply just coming up with it. It's actually part of his very nature that determines what the good is. And what has been good has always been good. So, for example, love is a virtue has always been good. And we understand the Trinity is having three persons. That means that there's always been a relationship of love between the three persons. Always. So strictly speaking, goodness is not identical with what God does or commands, strictly speaking. And, strictly speaking, goodness is not identical with something higher than God. Rather, goodness is derived from the very essence or nature of God. And I'm going to quote a philosopher to sum this up. Catherine A. Rogers, Anselm, like Augustine before him and Aquinas later, reject both horns of the Euthyphro dilemma. They call it a false dilemma. God neither conforms to nor invents the moral order. Rather, his very nature is a standard for value. So this is a very classical response to a classical problem. And I think this answer is quite sound. Okay, let's move on. This is an interesting one. It's called the genetic fallacy. When you think of Genesis, sometimes you think of beginnings or origins, things like that. This is faulting a belief based on its origin, confusing the causal origin of a belief with its justification. Another way to think about this is the history in which it comes to someone, confusing that with its justification. So he would be an example of that. Let's say someone reasons like this. I learned 1 plus 1 equals 2 from my second grade elementary teacher, but she turned out to be a child molester. Therefore, 1 plus 1 equals 2 is false. Right? Notice they're trying to fault the belief because of a dubious origin. And that dubious origin is this immoral teacher. But most of us would say this. Of course it's not true. Even though you learned it from, let's say, a dubious source, its truth is distinct from that. What makes 1 plus 1 equal 2 is not where you learned it. It's something else that's independent of where you learned it. A more subtle example now. My friend told me about Christianity, and he turned out to be a total hypocrite. Therefore, Christianity must be false. You know people that reason like this? Strictly speaking, this is as fallacious as the other example. It could be the case that every Christian on the face of the earth is a terrible person, is an absolutely immoral person, but it could still be the case that God exists. And the way He's revealed Himself in the Bible is accurate. It just means we need better Christians. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the truth value. That's independent. The truth value of Christianity is independent of where you learn it. If you learn it from a hypocritical pastor or whatever, that's independent. So people may be good practitioners or poor ones, but this says nothing about Christianity's status as true or false. Just as moral or immoral math teachers are irrelevant to the validity of mathematical concepts. So this is an important logical point to note. But Aristotle said something interesting about persuasion. One of the ways you persuade people is you act congruently with what you're saying. So if I say smoking is bad for you and I act congruently with it, that's one of the ways I persuade you. But what if I say smoking is bad for you, and I'm smoking all the time, right? I'm acting very inconsistent, that's incongruent. So that turns people off. So it may be the case that even though strictly speaking everything we said is true, and yet the manner in which Christians present themselves turns people off. And we need to understand that. There's a difference between something's logical strength and something's persuasive ability. And that's why you need to understand both. To persuade someone is different from just having a good argument. But we want to at least have a good argument, right? All right, good. Let's move on to the next one. Jeremy said he mentioned these, right? Self-defeating arguments. Okay. This one pops up a lot. That's why we're going to go through a lot of different examples of what a self-defeating argument is. So it's an argument that fails at satisfying its own criteria. Another way to think about it is an argument that if true is false and if false is false. We're going to see how that happens too. And a self-contradictory assertion, an assertion that has some sort of internal conflict within it. Now, just a side note, some things are self-contradictory the moment we think them. Other things are self-contradictory when I say them to someone else. And we're going to see examples of both. But you just need to know that that distinction. Okay, some things you can think in your mind and it's not self-contradictory, but once you say it to people, it becomes self-contradictory. So there's just a difference. I'm just going to call both self-defeating, self-contradictory. So we're going to go through a lot of examples, because this is probably one of the most common fallacies that you'll hear. It pops up in philosophy all the time. So the promulgate just means to share, to try to convince other people. Some things you can't do that without contradicting yourself. So a simple example of a self-defeating argument would say, you never say never, right? It fails at satisfying what it sets out to do. Never say this word. Which one, never? Well, you just said it. Now, you might think, hey, I can get around this. Don't ever say what? Never. Oh, you just failed again. So it seems like it'd be really difficult to get around this. Now, once again, we want to be sophisticated, right, with the way we understand logic. And some people, sometimes when they say that, they don't mean it strictly speaking. They're just saying it to mean something else, using language loosely, like, don't ever limit yourself. Don't ever, from the get-go, just think you can't do it. You know, never say never. So we need to understand that. When someone says that, they might not mean it seriously, but they might, too. So we need to get that from them. Hey, wait a second. Do you actually think that? This example we don't need to worry about, but there's some others, and we need to get down to the root of things. Do you actually mean that, or is it just hyperbole? Are you just saying it at the moment? That's a more obvious example. Here's another one. There are no absolute truths. What would be self-contradictory about this? Yeah, exactly. Well, this is taken to be an absolute truth. This isn't taken to be a relative or a limited truth. This is taken, when people say this, they mean for everybody. Throughout all history, there are no absolute truths. Hey, wait a second. If there aren't, you can't make that statement, right? But you'll hear this a lot. I've been to a lot of secular schools in my time. You're going to hear this a lot. And it's just self-contradictory. Here's an interesting one. God is unknowable. What could be self-contradictory about this? Well, they seem to know a few things. One, God exists. And secondly, there's something about him that's unknowable. So that's at least two things you know. Well, I thought God was unknowable. How come you know these two things about him? So that's self-contradictory, right? If something was actually unknowable, we would never even have it in our cognition. It would never even occur to us to even think it at all. So I think, strictly speaking, this is self-contradictory. It's a claim to know something about God, claiming that you can't know something about God. Okay. Here's another one. Pops up in philosophy a lot, especially with regard to ancient philosophy. And you hear these skeptics like Pyrrho and Avalia and different things. No one can know anything with certainty. You guys see, hey, wait a second, what about that? You seem to know at least that statement with certainty. So there's at least one statement you can know with certainty. Maybe, how about more? How about two? How about three? You can't trust anybody. This is an example of something that is self-contradictory when you try to share it, when you try to promulgate it. I don't think it's, strictly speaking, self-contradictory to just think in your head, I can't trust anybody. But if I try to persuade you, hey, don't trust anybody, the problem is to accept that. You have to trust me. You have to trust what I'm saying, right? But I'm telling you, don't trust what I'm saying. Don't trust, you know, what anybody says. So here's the funny thing about it. If I don't trust you, let's say someone's trying to persuade me, and I don't trust you, then I can trust people because I just reject your statement. And your statement is false. I can trust people. So in accepting your statement, in a sense, I get to the opposite, which is I can trust people. Now let's look at the reverse. If I do trust your statement that you can't trust anybody, well, then I can trust people. I just trusted you, and your statement is false. So no matter what, if I trust you or if I don't trust you, the statement turns out to be false. So once again, this is an example of something that when you try to share it, it becomes self-refuting. But you can think it in your own mind. I don't think the contradiction happens in your mind. That's not true of, for example, you can't know anything with certainty. Once you think that, the contradiction occurs. Okay? Because you can't know that with certainty. You don't even need to share that. So that's just unbelievable. Not in a positive sense, in the bad sense. You can't believe it. My undergraduate was in communications, it wasn't in philosophy, and I remember reading this statement in a book, and something about it bugged me, but I didn't have the philosophical categories to help me. I remember asking my teachers in communications, they didn't really get what I was getting at. But I think what I understood implicitly was there's a contradiction there, right? Because if communication is inherently ambiguous, that means it's part of the very nature of communication to be ambiguous. Was that statement ambiguous? Or did you think you could communicate clearly with me and I could understand your meaning? If you thought that, then that statement is false. You see, anyone that thinks the state, why would you try to communicate at all? What's the point of saying anything to anybody? The very fact that you're trying to talk to someone and get them to your point of view means that you think communication can be clear sometimes. Maybe not all the times, but at least sometimes. So yeah, I disagree with that. You can't generalize. I've heard this a ton too. What's wrong with this? It applies to everyone. You can't make statements that apply to everyone. And this applies to everyone. So, if you're generalizing, why can't I? Here's another one, Bertrand Russell. He said, what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. So this is a sort of negative formulation, but let me flip it to a positive formulation, and let's look at that. He's not the only one to have thought this, by the way. Something like, only true knowledge comes by science. So what would be wrong with this kind of statement? Only true knowledge comes by science. What would be wrong with it? Okay. So you could go along that route and say, hey, there are things I know that exist that aren't empirical, like you mentioned, testable with the five senses. Go ahead.
I was just going to say there's no way you could scientifically prove that.
Okay, we're going to say, what are you going to say? Well, that's a good point too. So let's say before Francis Bacon, did people have knowledge? You know, so those are both good points, and you could raise the point that actually right now I know things that you can't prove by science. But as you mentioned, a more fundamental problem with this is that the statement itself was not the result of science. You're not going to find any scientific journal and set of experiments that comes to the conclusion only true knowledge comes by science. That's actually not a scientific statement. I know it has the word science in it, but it's not a scientific statement. There's no set of beakers you can manipulate with different fluids that comes to the conclusion only true knowledge comes by science. This is not a scientific statement. Okay? What philosophers call this is scientism. This sounds like a word I just made up, but it's not. It's actually a real word. It's the view that superior or true knowledge only comes by science. And this is self-refuting, because you don't get that by science. And if anyone thinks that you do, just cite for me the journal. What journal, what experiment did you get that conclusion? You're never going to find one. This is actually a philosophical statement. So statements that deal with the nature of knowledge and how you know, and let's say the extent of knowledge, that's philosophical. So once again, just because it has the word science in it doesn't mean it's a scientific statement.
Mm-hmm. So he observes it. Does that mean he knows it in the philosophical sense?
Yeah, I would think so.
Okay, so obviously he has no science.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
So he actually knows it. He observed it and he.
Yeah.
So how, I guess I don't understand. How does he know it? What is knowledge there? It's just the fact that he observed it and recorded it and pulled it out?
Well, yeah, I think we're justified in trusting our senses unless there's some overriding reason to not trust our senses. And there may be sometimes. Let's say you're sleep deprived. You're under the influence of some sort of chemicals and things like that, right? But on balance, I think you're justified in trusting your senses. So if I'm appeared to right now, what color is this? It's not white. What is it? Tan? Okay. Yeah, okay. Let's say I'm being appeared to right now tan wall-y, in a tan wall-y sort of way. That the philosophers talk kind of funny. But I'm being appeared to in a tan wall sort of way. I'm justified in believing that unless there's some overriding defeater. Now, it could be the case that you know, I touch it and room goes through and it's some sort of... That's fine. But given there's no overriding defeaters, I'm justified in thinking that there's a tan wall there. You know, if Adam sees a leaf fall, he's justified in believing there was a leaf and it fell, even though it could possibly be God playing a trick on him, right? And God making this sort of illusion, you know. But unless he figures out it's an illusion or something like that, he's justified, and we're all justified. And that's just the way we go about in the search for knowledge. So babies, they don't start out distrusting their senses, right? They may get to a point where sometimes we distrust our senses. If we put a stick in the water and it looks bent, I'm going to distrust my senses because I know it's not bent. It's just an illusion. But yeah, even babies start off trusting their senses. Hey, that looks like mommy or something like that. You know, hey, I can, and the person that keeps on looking like mommy, hey, I think that is still her. I don't think it's another person that, you know, has a mask or something like that. So, and anyway, I think we're justified. Yeah, let's put it that way. So once again, even though the statement uses the word science, it's not about science. It's about knowledge. And by the way, I love science. I absolutely love science. I don't think there's anything to fear as far as a Christian with science. I don't know, you know, no matter how deep we split the atom or whatever, I think it's great. I love technology. I love science. For me, there's just nothing to fear. And it should be the case as well, right? If it is the case that this is God's creation, then all truth is God's truth, right? I'm not going to find anything that would necessarily contradict the Creator if we're doing good science, you know, if we're trying our best and such.
God doesn't exist in anthropology.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's something that I should...
You know, it's with anthropologists and sociology and things like that, I think there's a difference between the evidence and what conclusions you draw from it. Remember, this is what we discussed. Now, let's say you gather a set of data that says, you know, the belief sets of these different... tribes are radically different. And one thinks that God doesn't exist, the other thinks that gods are everywhere, animism, let's say. The other thinks that God is everything, like pantheism, like everything's God, you know. The other one was everything has a spirit in it, is an animism. And then the next tribe believes in monotheism, let's say very, very similar to Christianity. So, gathering all this data, it's one thing to gather the data and say, well, here's what they believed. It's another thing to say, therefore, remember, they're trying to pull out a conclusion from it. Therefore, God, there's no objective reality to God because people disagree. Look at all the disagreement. Therefore, there is no objective reality. And I can, for me, I can say good job on, you know, doing the work, but hey, you messed up in your conclusion, right? So, one common way they reason is, hey, if there was an objective reality to things, let's say God, how come people disagree? You tell me. Look at all the disagreement we have. Doesn't that mean necessarily God doesn't exist? And I'd say no. I mean, let's think about it strictly, right? So there's a time, there's a period in the earth where people disagreed about the shape of the earth, right? My question was the earth somehow shapeless when people disagreed? Did it have no form then because people disagreed? No. It was a certain shape, and people that thought otherwise were wrong. And so for me, big deal about disagreement. Whether we talk about slavery, you know, the majority might have thought it was right. That doesn't make it right. So I would just say the data doesn't warrant the conclusion. I like your data. Good job. It's very interesting. But the philosophical conclusion you've drawn that God doesn't exist because of disagreements, it's not a good one. That's not a reliable pattern of reasoning, right? Just because people disagree, there's no objective answer. That's not a reliable pattern of reasoning. And there's examples to show that. So, yeah, there's a lot of things. For example, evolution. There's many, many studies that the actual evidence I don't necessarily disagree with. The actual evidence. Now, what conclusions do you draw? That's a different story. That's a whole different animal. That's not the point today, but just to let you know, a lot of times it's not about the evidence. It's about what conclusions do you draw. Okay. I'll just go through a little bit more. We're already at 9. Let me just go through one or two more. I actually want to get to this interesting dream one. Let me see if it's coming up soon. No, it's not coming up soon. You guys kind of get the gist of self-refutation, right? Okay, I think that you do. Let me skip ahead then. Just examples of more self-refuting statements, and you guys will get these. I'll email them to you. Okay. All right, well, we'll just go through this. It's interesting. Okay. So, equivocation. It's when you change the definition of a word mid-argument. You know, people think they're getting what you're meaning, and then you're going on with your reasoning, and mid-argument, you just switch the definition of a word, and they don't know it. And when you do that, that's a fallacy. If you do change the definition, or if you stipulate something, that's fine. Just tell the other person, wait, I'm using this word in this way. You should know when I use God, I don't mean the Christian monotheist, I mean the other, whatever. That's fine if you stipulate it. But you can't just do it on people. Let me give you an example. So, donut holes in God. Let me give you an argument relating the two. Premise one, nothing is better than God. Most Christian theists, Christian believers in God would probably accept this. Two, donut holes are nothing. Oh no. Conclusion, therefore, donut holes are better than God. Now, strictly speaking, the form isn't precise, but I can put it in, let's say, modus ponens, and the form can be correct. And the thing is, we can agree to the premises, right? I mean, I think nothing is better than God, and I know donut holes are nothing. But I don't agree with the conclusion. Well, what the heck happened? How can I agree with premise one and premise two, but not agree with the conclusion? Well, it depends on the definition of nothing. Some word has changed its meaning, and it's probably this one. So let me amplify the argument a little bit. So nothing, and by that I mean something like not one of the things in the universe besides God, something like that, is better than God. So that's what I mean by nothing in the first sense. But when you get to the second premise, the nothing means something different. It means absolute nothingness. That's different. It's not a comparative notion. It's just nothing. So the conclusion doesn't follow. Because actually the two statements turn out to be separate. They have nothing to do with each other. Because you would have thought they would have because they both use the same concept of nothing. But because the definitions are different, these are all strangers. They have nothing to do with each other. So that's an example of equivocation. So you have to be careful when you're talking with people what they mean by God or what they mean by creation, whether someone's a young earth creationist or someone's an old earth but not an evolutionist, or they are an evolutionist and they're old earth, or, you know, people use terms in different ways. So part of it is just being careful and just, hey, what do you mean by that, you know? Okay. Let's see what's next. All right, let me go through this quick. I'll just skip this. So, once again, you'll get this. All right. I don't know what that is. I just found it on the internet. But I was searching unicorn, and there was this unicorn that looked like Batman. And I was like, I'll use it. Okay. Yeah, here's what I want to get to. This is called begging the question, circularity. It's assuming the thing that is supposed to be proved when it can be avoided. It's a philosophical question whether or not all assumptions can be avoided. But it is pretty much agreed, when you can avoid it and you didn't, you made a mistake. So here would be an example, a simple example of what's going on. Oh, never mind, this isn't the simple example. Let's say I'm trying to decide what is a dream world and what is the waking world. How would one go about figuring this out? What do you guys think? It's an interesting question. There are times when I thought I was in my apartment waking up, and then I actually woke up. You know, I just totally thought I was awake. So it's an interesting question. So how would one maybe begin to start to answer this question? What do you guys think? Go ahead.
Well, if strange things that aren't reality seem to be going on, you could assume that.
Mm-hmm.
Dream.
Okay. Good. Something like that. Good. So let's say we just look at each. So the dream world versus the real world. And we just drop a list of qualities. Like you mentioned, one is a weird quality, right? Strange things happen. But let's just do that. So let's say, firstly, the dream world sometimes seems to be a bit fuzzy, right? It's not sharp, so to speak. But at least in the waking world, sometimes it is. Most of the time it is. Like I said, unless you're just waking up or you're under the influence of something. There's a certain clarity that it has that, at least most of the time, is different from the dream world. Here's another one. In the dream world, I seem to play random persons. The other day, I was playing a superhero. I don't know why. But your person, the person that you play the role you play, changes. But in the waking world, I'm this guy. I'm the guy that, you know, has to pay his bills and, you know, do this and do that and has certain, you know, relationships with family and friends and things. And that's very same. There's a continuity of person. Here's another one. The scenario changes. I may be playing a superhero, or the next time, I don't know, just running away from some random person. I have dreams for some reason that I can jump really high. I don't know if you had the dream. I just run and then I jump super high. But when I'm coming down, it's always crazy. It's like, I jumped too high. So the scenario is different. But in the waking world, there's a continuity of scenario as well, right? Typically, dreams are short. I don't know if anyone, or especially myself, has ever had a dream. Let's say I've been awake for like 50 hours straight. I don't think I've ever had a dream that I remember that's lasted that long or has had that type of quality. The waking world, by contrast, sometimes is a little too long. Sometimes by the end of the day, we want to go to sleep before it's time. And one more interesting one. In the dream world, typically, I don't know if I've ever been able to remember the waking world. That's W. But in the waking world, I can remember the dream world. I just told you a few examples. So that's another difference. So this would be a sort of a list method of distinguishing between the two. So allegedly, we just consider the experience we're having and just list the qualities. And if the qualities matches more one or the other, then that is supposedly a good guide to helping us distinguish between the two. Okay? Now, I'm going to ask you, what's wrong with this?
You could be in the dream world and have all those qualities of the waking world.
Exactly. So, exactly. I've begged the question, how do I know this one is the real world? Right? I've assumed this one is the real world, and I'm going to list these and these qualities, and then that one is the dream world, and I'll list these and these qualities. How do I know that? That was the question to begin with. I've implicitly assumed it in my answer. So, as you mentioned, why can't this be the case? Why can't the dream world be the clear one with the continuity of person and the continuity of scenario? And the waking world be the fuzzy one where I turn into Superman and whatever? Why can't it be? You see, this list method hasn't answered the fundamental question of which is real and which isn't. Now, I'm going to mention in a second, it's not completely not useful. It's useful for certain things, but not for answering our question. So this is an example of begging the question. It assumes what we're trying to prove in the first place. So the list method has given us a way to distinguish. I think there is a difference between the two. But I just don't know which is the real and which is the imaginary. But there is a difference. So the list we drew up, I think it's a fair list.
There's one difference.
Okay.
When you switch them, you violate science by, for example, random scenarios. That would violate physics.
Well, what if this is a dream right now?
Well, I'm saying whichever one has random scenarios, scientifically you set up like a...
But that's only if you think science belongs to the real world, and that's only if you know which one is the real world. I know. But see, that depends if you made your totem in the real world. What if you didn't? What if I was in a dream and I got this totem and, you know. Yeah, exactly. No, so what you're saying, It actually assumes that I know this is the real world, and I know reality is a certain way, and you know. But that's what we don't know.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that if you set up video cameras for both scenarios, and then at some point you or someone has the opportunity to review them, be clear which one's real, which one's fake.
I think that depends if you knew. Like I said, continuity of scenario belong to the real world. But that's what we don't know. Because what if this is the dream world? And all these qualities we're listing with science and everything, this belongs to the dream realm. But nevertheless, I think there is a non-question begging way to answer this question. So the point isn't to give you the most airtight argument. It's just to show you a possible way of answering it that doesn't beg the question, that doesn't assume implicitly what we're trying to answer. So the list method did help us. It helped us distinguish the two. Now our question is, which one is the dream world and which one is the real world? Well, firstly, let's just start off labeling them neutrally, because I don't know. Let's say world one, I'm just going to call it world one. That's the fuzzy one. And I'm just going to call world two the clear one. So once again, it's neutral, right? I don't know which one's real, which one's false. Secondly, I'm going to start thinking about things I know about myself and which things on balance are more probable than their negations. Here's a few things I think I know about myself. Firstly, my existence is contingent, mortal, and limited. Therefore, I could permanently die in the real world. The only way this would be false would be if I was immortal physically. And I just don't think I'm that kind of being that is physically immortal. It seems much more likely that I'm not. So I take this as a premise. Here's another one. But I cannot permanently die in a false, illusory, or imaginary world, right? So right now I can imagine in my head that there's a dagger, and I can imagine it cutting my carotid artery. And I'm imagining it right now, but I'm not dead. Because imaginary things can't hurt you, right? So if there is this illusory world, it shouldn't be able to hurt me, so to speak. I shouldn't be able to permanently die. So, therefore, if there's a world in which I die but don't stay dead, let's say I keep on restarting or something like that. If I die, I pop up again. And if I die, I pop up again. Then that's the false world, because I know in the real world that doesn't happen. You know, once I jump off a bridge, boom, it's over. I get one life. So here's what I mean. This shouldn't happen in the real world where I get five lives, right? In the real world, you get one. But if there's a scenario in which, hey, you know, I die, but I start over again, die and start over again, that's not the real world. I know that's not the real world. So here would be the argument. Let's formulate it in the modus ponens that we talked about, just to be concise. If there is a world in which I die but don't stay dead, and I have the multiple lives like Mario, then the world is the imaginary false world. World one, the fuzzy one, is that world. So I've had the experience of dying before in that world. I'll call it a dream right now, but I don't want to beg the question. But I've had the experience. Therefore, world one is the imaginary world. So I hope you can see this is a kind of way of answering this question that's not begging the question. I think it's a good argument. I think it's more probable than false, but it's not super airtight. But you get the point that this is a way of answering the question that's different from the previous way where we beg the question. Okay, so we're a little bit over time. That's it for today. And thanks a lot, guys, for showing up. I really appreciate it. I'll see you guys again.
Thank you.
I don't want to keep you guys so much. So.
Have you seen the movie Inception?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I said the totem.
Yeah, the totem.